Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And I'm Phil Taylor. You can write us, Taylor at CIUT.FM, and check us out, Taylor-Report.com. And Phil Conlon is here. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
Today we're going to talk to Dan Glass of the UK-Canada Strategies of Protest Tour. Dan Glass is one of the world's best-known fighters on the environment. He's a climate activist, and he's one of those who is fighting, leading the fight against the expansion of airports around the world and the pollution caused by jet traffic. And it was Heathrow was going to add a runway, and Dan Glass and others said, no, you're not.
Well, we have a small airport in this town that we elected a mayor once because we wanted to keep a park that belongs to the people. And somehow these characters got in there and they built up their little airport anyway, and it's getting busier and busier. And you know, and that park has got more and more airplanes flying over it now.
Yeah. Dan was here in Toronto and addressed that, and we'll be getting some word further on that from him about what he makes of our little Parkett airport, which has got big jets coming. Later in the show, at about the halfway point, we're going to talk to Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com, and he has had some wise observations to make about the what has occurred in Libya and the madness of the journalism connected. So we'll be talking to him about that. We have some announcements. You have one, Phil, and I have another. Let's just say that Michael Parenti is going to be speaking in. He's coming to town. He's going to be in Toronto, and he's going to be in Hamilton. The announcement is November 1st, internationally renowned author and lecturer Michael Parenti, one of North America's leading progressive political analysts, is coming to Toronto. On Tuesday, November 1st, Parenti, whose latest book, The Face of Imperialism, was published earlier this year, will speak at the University of Toronto's McLeod Auditorium on the topic Imperialism Today and the 99% Solution, which the word is, these phrases are spreading, 99% Solution. There will be an admission of $10. Don't miss Michael Parenti at the McLeod Auditorium, 7:30 p.m., and that's sponsored by People's Voice newspaper, peoplesvoice.ca. For more information, you can call 416-469-2481. And, Phil, he's also talking in McMaster. You have the information on
On Thursday night, November the 3rd, Michael Parenti will be same subject, Imperialism Today and the 99%, will be at the McMaster University Information Technology Building, room AB102 at 1280 Main Street West in Hamilton. That's Thursday, November the 3rd at 7 p.m. For Michael Parenti in Hamilton. So you have two opportunities to get to meet Michael Parenti, and everybody should turn out. I mean, his presence in Toronto should be news.
Yeah.
I didn't read about it in the Star, though. I guess they missed the story, right?
Yeah, well, they miss a lot of stories. So you're trying to provide segues here. The Star has created an interesting problem for the Taylor Report. We told a story about the danger of misreporting stories apropos of Syria, particularly in light of what has happened in Libya, where journalism really played an active role in assisting the NATO bombardment of that country and the violent transfer of power and all that. And a lot of stories connected with Libya were shown to be false. Now, the NATO, and particularly the U.S. State Department, has moved their targets, and they're now targeting Syria. So we've alerted people that media function as enablers. They write a horror story or a shocking story, and people say, well, that's terrible. Somebody should do something. You set the stage by saying, somebody's got to do something, because obviously that regime is bad, bad, bad. So on Saturday, September 24, we saw this headline. It said, this is Toronto Star, it says, activist teen sister beheaded in custody. And human rights group says regime targeting activist families. And a long story about how this is just part and parcel of an overall strategy that if you have someone participating in a demonstration, you grab their loved ones and then you harm the loved ones in order to make the activists stop. An elaborate story. And the ugly part of it was that Amnesty International joined in and said that, oh, this seems to be true. And they're very concerned, and they're calling on the Syrian authorities to behave themselves and that sort of thing. So, well, we said we didn't believe it, and we'd like to see further evidence. So what later we had this story, and it appeared in the Toronto Star. The reason I'm reading these three headlines is that I'm scratching my head. I have the impression that the editors, and I've suggested this in the past, don't read their own paper. So the first story was about activist teen sisters being beheaded. Then, on October the 6th, Toronto Star had a story, and it says, Syrian TV interview cast doubt on beheading. Story about death in police custody drew global attention. By the way, and in this story, they bring the good news that the girl who had allegedly been beheaded had appeared on Syrian television and said, I'm okay, thanks. Nothing happened to me. And I really don't like people spreading the story that I was kidnapped by the police, taken and tortured, and had my head cut off. None of that being true, since I'm sitting here talking. And so the Star ran that, by the way, not mentioning that they had been among the papers spreading the story that this had beheading. They said that, you know, media around the world had carried that. They didn't say, including us. So now, and they ran a photograph of her appearing on television. There's a nice picture of her. She's a very nice woman. By the way, we're in this lovely new internet age where we're no longer trapped by the morning paper. Go and do your own homework. So you can go and check it out, and you'll see her. She's a nice person. I'm looking for her name, Zainab Al-Hosni. Zainab Al-Hosni. You'll find her. Anyway, she gave that nice interview. So we talked about that on this program.
We did.
So I have to bring you bad news. Well, at least head-scratching news, because yesterday's Toronto Star, make sure I have the date, October 30, Sunday, Toronto Star. The headline says, Syrian murder mystery in a brutal crackdown. Woman's tortured body released with brothers. It's her again, and they've got her beheaded again. They've got her tortured again, and they have her family all upset again. And there's nothing in the story mentions that she has appeared on Syrian television alive. Nothing in the story. By the way, Amnesty acknowledged it was her on television alive. They said, we made a mistake. Yesterday's Star reports her dead and beheaded again. And then along to illustrate their story, they have a picture of her. It's the picture taken from her live interview. So here's my theory. They operate. They have a kind of a robo system. Nobody was down there that morning, and somebody just pushed the button, and they pushed out the story. And somebody said, you know, any more inches to cover? No, we got it all covered. Let's go have lunch. Nobody noticed. Well, isn't that the picture of her alive? And we have a story saying she's dead. Anyway, they said, oh, no worry. Nobody's reading us anyhow. I think that's another theory. However, they identify the source of their story. It's Global Post. So I thought, well, again, you know, I'm free now. So I Global Posted. And Global Post says she's alive. All they say is that, you know, they've been printing, Global Post hates Syria. So, I mean, they have to keep the hate Syria fires burning. So Global Post said, well, she did appear on television. And her mother says, yeah, that's her. But now the mother thinks maybe she's dead. Well, that's a story. By the way, the mother doesn't live in Syria, it turns out. She's in Lebanon. So all this story's been coming from Lebanon in the first place. At the end of the day, what we're talking about is these are stories that are making it possible to have war with Syria. Because if she had been taken out of her home for the reasons they gave in order to pressure her brothers, and then tortured, and then beheaded, and then the mother told, by the way, the mother's original story was she had seen the body. That's how the story started. She claimed to have seen her, and therefore, you know, the Amnesty picked up the story. Then they, if that kind of story gets out, and Amnesty puts its mark on it saying, oh, yeah, this one's true, Well, we're into deep water because amnesty is a kind of a way in football you call a blocking back. They open the hole for the army to run through. So amnesty says, oh, yeah, it's a true story. Well, of course, when amnesty was caught with his pants down, they decided to say, no, we were wrong, but, you know, we still don't like Syria. As a matter of fact, my favorite amnesty story out of this one was that amnesty said, well, since it's not her, then we have to know, they have to explain whose body, the Syrian government has to say whose body it was. And the answer to that is, no, they don't. You don't know you have a body. You said you did. If I would say to the investigator, if it was an amnesty investigator, he came back and said, oh, we've affirmed that it is the girl's body, blah, blah. And then she shows up on Syrian television. I would say to the investigator two things. We're probably going to fire you. But if you want to hang around here, go and explain how you came by that false story. But you cannot tell me that Syria has to explain anything. What you have to explain is why you started this false story. Not, you know, Syria owes you something. No, amnesty, you know, amnesty, we have to all watch out. Amnesty is cranking stories every week against Syria. And we want to remember that, to remind everybody that the first war, the first time the government of George Bush, the elder, senior, larger, when he set out to war with Iraq and blasted Kuwait and Baghdad and elsewhere, he said that his wife had been watching an Amnesty International appearance before a congressional committee where a nurse from Kuwait had reported that she personally had witnessed children being thrown out of incubators onto the floor so that the Iraqi soldiers could take the incubators back to Baghdad. And so Bush's wife said, George, you have to do something. So he was fighting. He was going to bomb them because his wife was upset. That was the story. And it, of course, developed that the woman who told that story was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador.
And she was not a nurse. She was a high school student.
No, she seemed just a liar, actually.
Yeah.
So here's the story. Here's the thing is, you don't make foreign policy based on amnesty press releases. But they do want to. And this little episode where the star has her beheaded, then has her alive, and then beheads her again, should raise the teach us all, listen, papers are there to control us, in a sense. They're mm-hmm. setting the agenda. Somebody long ago said, we're ruled by the morning paper. And there is a lot of truth to that, although the power of the morning paper is declining, thank heaven.
Yeah. You know, I find it interesting that they would take the position, well, Syria has to answer for this body that may or may not exist. I mean, police all over the world, coroners, find bodies, right, who they don't always know they are. I mean, are you going to say Stephen Harper has to answer for the body that was found in Toronto Harbor? It's ridiculous. Amnesty doesn't say that, right? So why would you say it about Syria?
Exactly. Yeah. And by the way, why not at least – you notice one of the things lacking is they don't make any effort – to even record the opinion of the people about whom they're talking, which is always you realize you've entered in extremely dangerous territory when they know that they have sufficiently demonized the person they're talking about, that the person they're talking about has no right to respond at all. They don't, I mean, my guess is that if you actually could go to the hospital or to the mortuary where that girl's remains were, then. I should say the alleged blah, blah, you would probably get really interesting answers. Since those people are educated people, medical people, professionals, they might have something interesting to tell you, you amnesty investigators, you brilliant guys who dominate our world and in the world, the realm of human rights and continually lecture us and patronize us and tell us that you're champions of human rights. And then you come pull a story like this one. By the way, I haven't heard of anybody from Amnesty losing a job. Why don't they lose their jobs? I mean, they spread a story which could have immediately inflamed a number of people. I mean, lives could be lost as a result. And with the demonization of Syria that we're now experiencing, by the way, leading the charge is Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and, of course, the U.S. and France and there's now a, we now see a cabal of the monarchs of the Gulf, and they have targeted Syria. Al Jazeera is right in the middle of all this. Since that's going on, we would expect people who label themselves as human rights to be careful to record the evidence provided to them by all witnesses, not just their own favorites, or you know, or their homeboy. In the case of Human Rights Watch, we noted on this program, you're listening to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. But we made note of the fact that Human Rights Watch, during the buildup to the destruction of much of the Libyan infrastructure, which extremely valuable to Libyan people, now lost, we probably forever, at least for the foreseeable future, Human Rights Watch had an officer of their organization attending White House meetings. And to me, that's automatic disqualification in terms of credibility. You know, all that means to me is, yes, you know Hillary personally. Congratulations. But since we are suspicious of the use of power and violence by a superpower, we say, don't tell me that you believe in human rights and you're sitting there with Hillary. By the way, we're having a little trouble reaching our good friend in Dan Glass. I just want to update you if you were saying, hey, wait a minute, I want to hear about Dan Glass. We're working on this. So I think we'll take a brief break, see if we can help out. And we'll be back to talk, we hope, with Dan Glass about the Toronto Airport, Island Airport. And we're going to later we'll talk to Stephen Gowans. And this is the Taylor Report. Be right back.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. You made the 2011 CIUT Fall Membership Drive a huge success. Without your donations, CIUT would not be possible. So thank you for helping CIUT reach 25 years on the FM dial. Remember, pay your pledges and be entered into our grand prize draws. Go to www.ciut.fm for more information. Cheers to our sponsors, Urbane Cyclists, The Briars Resort, Good Catch Food, and Catering for You.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And we're back. Taylor Report, and Phil Collins is with me, and Dan Glass is, we're still attempting to reach him, and my apologies to everybody if we haven't yet been able to produce it. We will continue to work on it. I will make sure I tell you that there's an organization here in Toronto, I should say Canada-wide, I guess, called communityair.org, and that's Brian Eiler, communityair.org, and you can go to their site and you can read a good account of Dan Glass's appearance here in Toronto, together with other activists. We'll fill in some story on this while we're at this. Dan became famous worldwide because of his attachment to Prime Minister Gordon Brown. By that I mean he used super glue during a handshake, and poor old Brown didn't know what to do, since it's kind of hard to leave a guy who's attached to you, literally. So, and it set up the situation where Dan Glass was then able to give a talk. Actually, Gordon Brown, most of these politicians are lots more slippery than even Dan Glass knew. He got away, but Glass made the point that of why this was important, being that these airlines are major polluters, and as it applies to I'm going to let Phil help me out here with a. We are working as I speak. The issue was that he had the main issue for us, he pointed out, is that short-term flights are the worst for pollution. Took me a long time to say it. That you get in the most difficulty. The reason I handed over my phone is I think we're working around. Glass found us. And so we think we're going to be able to get him on the line. But his point being that when you were talking about the Toronto airport, and I think we're going to be able to get him here shortly, is that you have, because of the nature of the runways and the distances they're going to be flying, actually the pollution is worse. So, and he was able to convey, I mean, he really reached a mass audience in Britain. They were able to prevent the expansion of the famous Heathrow Airport. There was a new runway. As far as I know, they were successful in blocking expansion of that runway. We also have the Pickering Airport, am I right?
But yeah, do you remember
that's an issue here?
This issue in Japan a generation or so ago when Japanese farmers in the thousands occupied fertile land and fought for years to prevent the Japanese authorities from extending their major airport. I think they eventually lost. But they put up a hell of a fight, and it went on for a long, long time. You know.
Yeah. But sometimes those wars are not won. I mean, and of course, I'm sure Dan will be the first to say eternal vigilance is the price of not having a big airport. Because, you know, these guys weren't born yesterday either, and they have a lot of high-powered folks who put things through. You're quite right. In Toronto, this is a big issue. And I think, by the way, we're joined by Dan Glass. Are you there, Dan? Hello, Dan? We think we are. This is... I'm sure there's something is up here.
I think
here.
The control tower at Pearson is sending out vibes and preventing this connection.
It could be that Alex has got him... She finds him very interesting. They're probably talking, and then she can give us a report on what to do. But at any rate, they were successful. Dan's notoriety and the notoriety of this work, I guess they have a lot of people concerned because he wasn't allowed to visit the United States. As you know, it's the freest country in the world, and unlike those countries we're all trying to liberate. It was the authorities decided it wasn't in the best interest of American people to have Dan Glass as a visitor. And, of course, they were not notified of this decision on their behalf, but it was taken. In the moments while we're waiting, I want to finish a final point on this Middle East thing, the legend about democracies and how everybody loves this. I want to remind everybody that the Palestinians have a democracy. They had a vote. It was a supervised, internationally observed vote, and they voted for an organization called Hamas. And we, Canada and the United States, refused to acknowledge the result, saying, no, you can't have that. And in Lebanon, a major political party doesn't represent everybody, but it represents a portion of the electorate of Lebanon called Hezbollah, ran for office and was elected, and they are not admitted here. They are not no one can talk to them. So we can't really claim that we're interested in free elections. Suppose, for example, the Tunisians yesterday or 2 weeks ago decided, well, boy, we really like the Islamic Republic, and we think people ought to leave Syria alone, and that party were elected. No, that would not be permitted. So, in fact, parliamentary process, democracy, our commitment to it is all bunk. As was pointed out, we're sitting on Haiti. We're helping occupy Haiti. Haiti hasn't had an elected leader their elected leader, Mr. Aristide, and his party have not been allowed to participate in Haiti now for a decade. That was the good work of Canada, France, the United States. Aristide was removed from office, and while he was away, the only country that he was safe in was South Africa. He was a guest of Nelson Mandela and President Zuma of South Africa. While he was there, his party was functioning, but not allowed to contend for office. His party wasn't allowed to run in the most recent elections in Haiti. Yet the Toronto Star and Globe Mail, everybody told us they had elections. No, they didn't. What we are talking about is a controlled process. So there is. For example, when they talk about now we will see a democracy election in Libya. The Libyans will be allowed to choose someone who likes NATO. They're not going to be allowed to choose anyone who does not like NATO. That's going to, no, that will not be possible. So we shouldn't be buying into that.
Just to keep our readers, there's a lot of technical activity going on in the studio.
That's right. Every effort is being made. Every effort.
We are really trying to talk to Dan Glass, and he's within reach. He's just not quite here yet.
Yeah. And but we have identified, the, by the way, a major source of information on the work of Dan Glass, particularly his visit to Canada, and it's CommunityAir, communityair.org. Brian Eiler. We're going to make it a point, by the way, we'll catch up with Mr. Eiler, because to the value of a visit by someone such as Dan Glass, and there were others as well, is to extend their work and to make sure that they are heard. And I don't believe there was much coverage beyond the what I would call community press and community radio of the Dan Glass visit. So if they are to succeed, we need this kind of discussion.
Dan, by the way, has a website I just found. It's called aviationjustice.org. And it sounds like it's a website devoted to this issue, which is an international issue. I mean, everybody has to deal with this. Where characters can walk in and take, just grab a piece of your community and say, we're going to land big airplanes right down your main street.
Yeah. By the way, and two, he's got an organization. He's very creative. I think they're called Plain Stupid. Or something. Isn't that what it's called? Pretty creative. And while we're at it, too, is Betsatun is having a...
Betsatun is having an event on Friday night, which is it's an academic discussion. They don't tell us who the academics are, but they want you to come. And
what's the title?
I think we should go. It's Palestine's UN Bid, The Way Forward or a Diversion. That should be a very lively debate.
That's a major debate.
And that's Friday, November 4th at 7 p.m. at Betsatun at 612 Markham Street. And basically, I mean, you know, there's a real division of opinion there as to whether or not the foray at the United Nations was a good idea or a bad idea. And I think that there are people of goodwill who hold both opinions.
Absolutely.
People of bad will who have opinions, too. But we don't understand those, right?
I just mentioned that Hamas was elected, and that represents people of Gaza. Yeah. And they had their doubts about this. Yeah. They said go ahead, but they had their doubts. Yeah. Anyway, we're going to go ahead. We have Dan Glass. We cornered him. Are you there, Dan?
Gotcha. You got me.
Hey, you're a very patient man for a man who's not known to be patient. Thank you for thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Dan, you've had a tour of Canada. Tell us about our problems here. What have you been talking about?
Well, it's been an amazing month. I'm in Vancouver now, and we started off in Toronto because we were invited to North America, all across North America, to work at Skillshare with communities who are predominantly tackling airport expansion, but all kinds of polluting industries, from massive road plans to coal-fired power stations, and we're off to the tar sands next. Was particularly invited because of my experience with the Heathrow Third Runway campaign in the UK.
Yeah. Now, by the way, just to remind us, that it was a tremendous victory. I mean, and by the way, we're saying you must have the second battle must be to consolidate it, but what did you accomplish there? What was the issue?
It was a massive grassroots mobilization against the Heathrow Third Runway expansion. So British airport authorities wanted to build another runway which would have produced the equivalent amount of carbon emissions as the size of Kenya, as Kenya does per year.
Oh,
so one runway for an airport produced a massive amount of emissions. And so through a massive mobilization of activists, residents, scientists, human rights advocates, anti-racist campaigners, anti-poverty campaigners, we pulled all the pillars out from under their plans and put the Heathrow Third Runway plans back to the drawing board. And partly the reason why we focused on aviation is because aviation emissions is the fastest growing cause of global CO2 emissions. You've got like coal and you've got the tar sands, etc., which are the biggest contributor to CO2 emissions, but aviation is the fastest growing. And particularly in North America, there's 3,000 plus airport expansion plans altogether. So it's quite shocking, and it puts the Heathrow Third Runway campaign into perspective, because it really reminds us of what we've still got to do if we are to stop climate change.
But boy, it is a challenge. And incidentally, the Americans are not too happy and too anxious to hear your message. I understand they didn't welcome you exactly.
Not, in fact, I've probably never had such an unwelcome in my life. So John Stewart and myself were invited to both Canada and America. And I, when I tried to get my visa for America when I was in the UK, I was met by the FBI. And when John got on, he only got a month of work. He got a plane. He'd never flown transatlantic before. He got on a plane to New York JFK Airport. John Stewart had never been arrested. You know, he's 60-odd, lovely man, and was arrested on the plane in front of everyone when he got to New York JFK, arrested by six FBI guards,
yikes,
taken through the airport, questioned for 6 hours, and sent packing back to London. And they said to both of us, well, you can try applying for your visa again after the tour. So it's really quite telling that obviously they don't want us to be discussing anything which challenges business as usual. But actually, it was a bit of an own goal for the FBI because the tour has had like 4 or 5 times more attention than it would have had anyway. And actually, yeah, I think it's a very important thing that we can't fool ourselves into believing that, you know, we can ask the powers that be nicely to, you know, not expand the police industries because they've got so much at stake. You know, they've got the FBI, the CIA, all the power structures there to suppress dissent. So,
By the way, the airlines, when you fly, they must look at you and think, why, this is a waste of a ticket.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, completely. I mean, I was very much looking forward to get the boat from Liverpool in England to Chester in America. I would have absolutely loved it. I took time off work.
Well, you are one of the, you do advocate that we find alternate means of transport, right? We don't have to be super jets everywhere.
Oh, exactly. I mean, Play Stupid, which is a direct action aviation anti-airport expansion network that I'm with, we're not against flying per se. We obviously realise that, you know, if you're in Toronto and you've got family in Australia, you will probably need to fly there. But what we are advocating is that everything has to be within our ecological means. Mm-hmm. Climate change is at such a severe stage, we really have to reduce the biggest polluting industries and, most importantly, put that money into sustainable land transport alternatives. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in the UK, for example, our focus is on domestic flights. We've got, if anyone's ever been on the trains in the UK, you'll see how bad they are. They're the most inefficient and expensive train system in Europe. Mm-hmm. So all the money that's being put into big, exhausting, polluting planes should actually be put quick, sharp into sustainable land transport.
Well, now, Dan, that's also a link with our issue of the Toronto Island Airport, right? I mean, these short-distance flights are the worst. Is that right?
They're the worst because most emissions happen in takeoff and landing. So the shorter they are, with just the more nonsensical it is when it comes to pollutants and emissions.
What did you make of our Toronto airport issue? Did you have a look at it and talk to people like Brian Eiler? And what did you make of our situation?
I found it very inspiring, very, very inspiring. We did a lot of workshops and events with not just the Toronto Island and the Toronto City Airport community, but a lot of other different projects and workshops projects and organisations around Toronto who are tackling environmental injustice. Mm-hmm. So we were looking at it from a kind of wide perspective, as in who's causing the problems and who's getting affected all across the production line. So that's part of the reason for going to Tar Sands, because we met Tar Sands activists in Toronto because, you know, the planes are just one end of the production line. You've got the oil sand, the tar sands at the other end, as well as mining and everything. So we met up with a lot of anti-racist activists, for example, in Toronto. I was very inspired by a different book list, for example, which I know that you know, who has a wealth of events and projects around environmental justice, racial justice, and joining the dots, really, between who is causing the problem and who's being affected on race, class, gender, environmental grounds. So it was joining the dots, really, with a lot of different inspiring grassroots groups all across Toronto.
Mm-hmm. This is Dan Glass, and he is a climate activist. And then, so you're going to go to the Tar Sands. Your speaking tour is basically over, but you're going to go have a look and join, I assume, some demonstration.
In the Tar Sands, yes, because what we're doing is strategizing with all kinds of communities on how we can really bring the aviation industry back down to earth as such, bring it back to sustainable levels, and simultaneously invest in sustainable land transport. The other key aspect, though, is much around civil rights and our right to freedom of speech. So, for example, John and myself not getting into America is very much a civil rights issue.
Absolutely.
So we support everyone to be able to, you know, speak out.
You know, Al Gore should be the one out there with his arm around you if he believes in – he's always talking about global – he ought to be standing there at the airport saying, let this man in.
Exactly, exactly. There's been an incredible amount of support from all over North America. I mean, quite rightly, the communities who are living under the flight path in America and Canada, who've got higher levels of asthma and cancer and, you know what, you name what else, you know, are desperate to hear campaigning strategies of how we can successfully take down the aviation beast to sustainable levels. And also, I think one thing I've been very inspired by across Canada is the wealth of creativity when it comes to campaigning tactics. For example, we've done a lot of we've done, in a kind of joking manner, but with a serious undertone, a lot of superglue training workshops in relation to the incident with the Prime Minister in the UK.
I was going to say, I have to ask you, of course, how you became so attached to Gordon Brown.
How I came attached to good old Gordon Brown. Well, this is the quite hilariously, ridiculously funny story as to why I didn't get into America. So I met Gordon Brown, the ex-Prime Minister, in July 2008, because I was invited to 10 Downing Street, obviously where he lives, because I won a campaigning award. I've been working with communities who live under flight paths in the UK for years, which are disproportionately, you know, economically marginalised and/or communities of colour, often the same thing, and you know, with the health impacts and everything else. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I won this award, and when I got the invitation through my door, it said, the patron was Gordon Brown, and I'm like, this is ridiculous. I can't accept an award for working with communities who are affected by airport pollution. Getting off the man who wants to expand all the airports and defer Heathrow third runway, I was like, I can't do this. And I said to my sister, I was like, well, what can I do to highlight the hypocrisy? And she said, oh, well, why don't you write a speech for the communities who you work with and, I don't know, superglue yourself to him and say the speech to him. And I was like, you know what, that's a very good idea. And she said, no, I was joking, don't superglue yourself to the Prime Minister. Anyway, too late, the thought was already in my mind. And then for a month before the award ceremony, I was practising on my housemate, the unsung hero, of how to get the superglue on properly so it sticks long enough. And I've been collating this speech by the communities under the flight path, ready to say it. I had to learn it off by heart and say it to him when I was stuck to him. And so what the eventual strategy, the superglue strategy, was I had superglue in little bags attached to the outside of my boxes, and I had a hole in my trouser pocket. So when it came to my turn to shake his hand with my right hand and his right hand, and then I stuck myself to his sleeve on his right arm. And it was the biggest news story in the world the next day, much to my mum's horror. And so I shook his hand, and then I stuck myself to his arm and said, please don't move, Mr. Prime Minister. And the whole room went quiet, and I said, I have to stuck myself to your arm. Don't worry, this is a peaceful stunt in line with Plain Stupid's commitment to peaceful action, blah, blah, even though that's another story. And then said, I have stuck myself to your arm to say that you can run away from my arm eventually, but you can't run away from climate change. It's time that you stood up for the British public and stood up to the bullies of the British airport authorities. We can be climate change, but it's not going to come about by expanding the world's largest airport. And by that time, all the people in the room knew, who were a lot of campaigners, they knew that I wasn't going to explode, and they knew that it was a stunt.
Only your mother was going to explode.
Oh, my mum, she's lost the ability to speak when she saw it on the front page of the papers. but bless my nan, so I went and saw my nan, who was in hospital at the time, and she thought I was in the papers just for winning the award, and I didn't want to burst her bubble and tell her it was because I had superglue on my hands. But it was that stunt, which was, you know, obviously peaceful, jokey, in the spirit of civil disobedience, and actually, what were they expecting? You know, I'm getting an award for campaigning, and a role of a campaigner is to look for opportunities to highlight injustice, and I took it with both hands.
Of course. Why should he get votes off of meeting you, but you get no support for your cause?
Exactly, exactly. So the funny thing was, you know, Gordon Brown played it down, I didn't get arrested, of course. I didn't press charges or anything.
It's,
you know,
press
it was very much in the spirit of democracy at work. But then when I went to get my, well, went to try and have my visa interview in Belfast, I was met by a man, Eric Jackson from the FBI. I wasn't even allowed in the building. He met me and he said, are you Darren Glass? And I said, yes. He said, well, I'm not going to do the American accent because I'm rubbish.
That was a very good accent.
He said, you Darren Glass? And I said, yeah. He's like, I've come to talk to you about the incident. And I was thinking, which incident? And he said, the super glue. I just want to know what you would do if you met Obama. And I'm like, I would congratulate him because his policies are a lot stronger on climate change than Gordon Brown's was. And he was like, oh, well, I can't believe it's you. You know, you're a nice, young, articulate man. And I was thinking, what, do you expect me to turn up at my visa interview just doused in superglue with a D-Lock around my neck? But so in the end, he was, you know, I was saying, you know, as a campaigner, it's your role to be creative and original. I'm not going to, you know, I'm not a superglue addict. And of course, I'm not going to superglue myself to Obama unless I want to end up in Guantanamo. You know, and it's all part, and that was it really. And questions, wow. all kinds of questions. So it's obvious they don't want us to talk about aviation justice,
they don't want your glue, and they don't want to hear you speak.
Exactly.
Mainly, they don't want you to hear you speak.
They're forgetting, you know, they're forgetting their First Amendment about freedom of speech and freedom of expression. They're obviously forgetting their commitment to climate change as well. So, you know, I guess we've just got to continue on. And there's a huge campaign in America. There's a huge campaign in America now to hear John and myself. But B, there's been a lot of brilliant connections between Canadian communities, American communities, and British communities who are all living within the nations of some of the biggest polluting industries. So there's a lot of brilliant stuff that's happened and a lot of great networks made.
Yeah. Well, Dan, we're very impressed. We're very delighted. We're sorry we were slow getting you. We thank you for your patience, and we look forward to talking to you some more. We're going to have to follow this issue, so we really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks so much, and have a good rest of the day to everyone.
Okay, Dan. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Dan Glass, climate activist, and who was once attached to Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Stuck on him. Well, anyway, I beat the heck out of that joke. And we're going to be talking shortly with Stephen Gowans, who has, it's gowans.wordpress.com. And by the way, while we're getting him on the line, I want to read a headline from The Onion, which I think is apropos of our reporting here. The headline is, Boardwalk Con Men Hit Hard by Sharp Decrease in Chumps. So that's what we believe. You listen to Taylor Report and don't be a chump. Boardwalk Con Men Hit Hard by Sharp Decrease in Chumps. If you saw the Toronto Star and those three little stories about the same woman where she was dead, she was alive, she was dead, you'll know that you shouldn't be a chump. Now, we're going to talk primarily with Stephen Gowans, and again, it's gowans.wordpress.com, about his article on what Libyans have achieved. And it's a very nice Jonathan Swift-style piece. He also has a longer piece on the social democracy and what its political successes and failures have been. I'll probably ask him, I know I will, about the fact that Social Democrats of Europe supported the bombing of Libya. And why they take dictation from NATO. We had Diane Johnson, for example, on this program, and Diane Johnson said to us that it was really disappointing that the so-called French left all were what we call AWOL at the time of the attacks on Libya. Hey, did we mention, while we're waiting for Mr. Gowans, we're having a bad hair day, as they call it. There's a Clint Eastwood, that's what we should say up front. Clint Eastwood, Republican big shot, former mayor of Carmel, California, right-winger, has made a movie about J. Edgar Hoover. I haven't seen it, but I would say make sure you put Clint Eastwood's name at the top so you understand where this is coming from. On the billboards that I'm seeing around town. It says, he was the most powerful man in the world. That's a lie. He was a vicious secret police chief of the United States. He was not the most powerful man in the world. He may have had dreams like that, but he wasn't real. Hey, we're joined by Stephen Gowans. Are you there, Stephen?
I'm here. Hello.
Hey, Stephen. We really appreciate your patience. We had a little problem with locating our first interview today. You've written in gowans.wordpress.com a list of things that the liberated Libyans have gained. Could you run down what you think they have gained?
Yeah, I wrote this because in the aftermath of Gaddafi's assassination, there was a lot of talk about 41 years of brutal oppression, and people didn't really provide any details about what the brutal oppression was, which always suggests that they don't really have any. Mm-hmm. Well, they don't have the details. It's simply a phrase, brutal oppression.
Mm-hmm.
So I simply pointed out that there had been 41 years. If you want to look at brutal oppressions, you could also look at the other side. Well, I mean, you could say brutal oppressions without pointing out exactly what there were, but on the other side, we had, first of all, Gaddafi overthrowing the king, King mm-hmm. Idris I. That hardly seemed to be oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, under Gaddafi's rule, Libya became or had the highest standard of living in Africa.
It didn't start with the highest.
No, it started with a very low level of economic development.
Mm-hmm.
So that was hardly a brutal oppression.
Mm-hmm.
Gaddafi had made a number of contributions, very generous ones, to national liberation movements and to sub-Saharan African countries. That was hardly brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And you could go on and on with the number of contributions that Gaddafi had made. But my concern was that these weren't being acknowledged and mm-hmm. that he's being portrayed as brutally oppressive. And if you want to portray him as brutally oppressive, well, that's fine, but at least tell us why he's brutally oppressive. Mm-hmm. And no one has been doing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and by the way, yes, and we are in this rather curious world where the celebration of, they say, well, at long last, they're going to be able to rule themselves. Well, the Palestinians exercised self-rule. They had an election. What was our take on that one?
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, how is it that they're going to be able to rule themselves? I mean, if we look at the transitional or the National Transitional Council, the so-called interim government, it's curious that the head of the interim government announced that some of the restrictions that the Gaddafi government had placed on polygyny would be lifted. certainly something that, I mean, this is a decision he's making without consulting with Libyans.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, this kind of thing would be based on the input that Libyans provide to the government, but that's not happening here. Also, I mean, in a larger sense, you can ask, well, you know, just how much independence are Libyans going to have since their society and their economy is going to be dominated by NATO powers operating through this National Transitional Council? And an interesting question that you should ask about the Transitional National Council is, you know, where does it come from? People accept it as the legitimate interim government, but where did it come from? I mean, you had this situation where you have chaos in this massive disruption within Libya, and the United States and other Western countries get together and they say, well, you know, we should appoint some people, some exiles that perhaps could represent our interests, and we'll call them a national council and give them diplomatic support and money so that they can kind of establish themselves on the world stage. But who appointed them? I mean, it's certainly not which mm-hmm. Libyans appointed them. And we can see that there's a huge, I mean, the rebel movement is very heterogeneous. And that the Transitional National Council presumably doesn't represent all elements of the rebel movement.
It is And by the way, you're quite right, and this should have been and was asked. And how about the flimsiness of the answer we all got, which was, well, we don't really know who they are. We're just recognizing them and bombing their country for them.
Yes.
we were having our leg pulled, right? They knew very well who they were.
Oh, yeah. Yes, they did. I mean, the significant people in the Transitional National Council are exiles who are connected with the United States in various ways, usually through the CIA.
Yeah. And, boy, do they have interesting histories, having been involved in Afghanistan and not only Afghanistan, and other places working as the Libyan Fighters Group?
The Libyan Islamic Fighters Group. And you're thinking of the military head of Tripoli, who is certainly central to that group, who had fought in Afghanistan with Osama bin Laden and others against the Soviets, and also had fought against the United States in Iraq, and had been imprisoned by the U.S. and then let go, and then imprisoned in Libya and released.
Yes.
Another interesting thing that people don't often acknowledge or point out is that there's been this long-standing tension or conflict between Gaddafi and these Islamic forces in Libya, which were centered in the eastern part of the country around Benghazi. And the way in which, the story is told now is as if this Islamic insurgency and uprising is suddenly, has been portrayed as some kind of democratic uprising by people throwing off this brutal and oppressive dictator. And I suppose you could argue that Gaddafi was oppressive in the sense that he was trying to oppress this Islamic movement.
Mm-hmm.
Under
the U.S., you could win an award for that somewhere else. You just couldn't win one in Libya.
Well, exactly. And it's significant that when NATO and the West decided that it needed to intervene, that Gaddafi objected and said, well, you don't understand. I mean, these are people associated with al-Qaeda who are behind the uprising.
Yes.
And I'm simply trying to put that down in the way I have in previous years. In the 90s, there was a conflict or an armed rebellion that was put down. And that was dismissed. He's just making that up.
They said that up front, but they did know that it was true.
Mm-hmm.
You notice how, Mr. Harper and Mr. Obama, sometimes people think, oh, there's Islamophobia. Then in the case of Libya, it turned into Islamophilia. They seem rather unstable, these guys, the ones in Ottawa and Washington. I don't know how we trust them. That's rhetorical. I'm sorry. let me say, by the way, this is Stephen Gowans, and it's gowans.wordpress.com. And Stephen, you had another column where you quoted the U.S. ambassador to Libya, and you said he was echoing Cecil Rhodes of a century or so ago. Walk us through that a bit. What was the point there?
Right. And Cecil Rhodes of the great British imperialist, who had written that he'd seen people demanding bread on the streets of Britain, and he thought, well, the solution to that, to avoid a civil war, which he really meant a class war in Britain, was imperialism. He said that quite clearly, imperialism.
Yes, they used to be very proud of it.
Right. I mean, so we have new markets. We have to conquer new markets to give these people jobs, to allow them to emigrate and settle in new places like Rhodesia.
Mm-hmm.
And then along comes the new U.S. ambassador to Libya, and he says, well, the crown and the jewel for Libya is oil, but, there are all kinds of opportunities here. There are all kinds of reconstruction opportunities. There's infrastructure opportunities. Well, this is going to be great for jobs in the United States, which struck me as being, paralleling what it was that Rhodes had said.
Maybe, Stephen, you should perhaps give a Cecil Rhodes Award every year to the contemporaries, spokespersons who most resemble him. Stephen, you also quote Robert Mugabe's speech at the United Nations, and Mugabe gets nothing but opprobrium in our first. What did you take from that speech? And I always have to ask you, what is the situation with the diamonds today of Zimbabwe? Are they going to be able to finally market their diamonds and bring more income to the economy?
Well, to answer your second question, the second question is really difficult for me to understand, so I can't really offer a good answer because I think the answer is confused.
Mm-hmm.
There's certainly an attempt to stop Zimbabwe from having its diamonds approved for sale.
But they have to be vetted by a European body.
Yeah. Yeah. Or by a world body in which there's consensus required, and one of the groups that's that has withheld approval is a Canadian NGO. In fact, two Canadian NGOs. So Canada and the United States are certainly behind this attempt to block Zimbabwe from selling its diamonds or having approval for selling its diamonds.
And by the way, Zimbabwe had elections too. We should remind people. All this talk about. They held elections, and the NGO's favorite got beat. But so then therefore he has to be overthrown. Am I right?
Yes, that's right. Well, I mean, there are interesting parallels too between Libya and Zimbabwe, and I suppose it might be said then that Mugabe's attitude toward Libya has been shaped by that.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, Mugabe, who's often denounced everywhere, including on the left, was at the UN General Assembly. And he made a speech that, if you read it, should resonate with people who are on the political left. But, of course, it's doubtful that anyone on the political left will read his speech. Instead, they'll wait for what the Globe and Mail or the U.S. or the New York Times tells you he said.
Mm-hmm. What that demon said today.
Yes.
Yes, but he made the point that 100% support for the Palestinian cause.
Mm-hmm.
He also said that the International Criminal Court seems to target underdeveloped but particularly African countries.
It does, yes.
Seems to be true, as near as I can make out.
Yes, and it certainly targeted, in the case of Libya, the kind of the indictments or the charges that were brought against Gaddafi and his sons were ridiculous charges. Ridiculous in the sense that they've been kind of disputed and refuted by Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International.
Yeah. Now, Stephen, last point. I mean, apropos of all this, we're in a culture which never questions NATO decisions. I can't get you into it today, but you have an article pointing out social democracy hasn't played a terribly good role. We had a kind of embarrassing, feckless debate, which led nowhere, while the bombs were falling. We ought to worry about people who are lying to us, who are have the capitals here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, trying to corner Mr. Mugabe.
Yes, exactly.
So, Stephen, it's been great talking to you. We always enjoy your writing, and I hope we can come back maybe a week or two. You've done a very long piece. I really recommend everybody go gowans.wordpress.com and read it. Discussion of social democracy and its function in Western, so-called Western democracies. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
All right, bye
bye,
Stephen Gowans, and this is the Taylor Report, and you can write to us taylor@ciut.com. What did I say? Taylor@ciut.fm. I got it. And I sometimes listen to the show, too. Taylor-report.com. You can find us on the web. And we sure enjoyed Dan Glass and Phil Conlon and Alex. Thanks very much. And we'll see you next week.